Faye, it's that time of year again. This episode's coming out right after match day, so congratulations to all of you who just matched into the best specialty ever.
Yes, congratulations to all of you who are matched into OBGYN, and we know that sometimes, even after the match, we may be a little bit anxious about starting intern year.
Yes, so for the last several years, Faye and myself, as well as a team of really excellent individuals, have come up with the hashtag OBGYN Intern Challenge residency preparatory curriculum delivered via text message once a day for a month leading up to intern year.
Yes, so if you want to get signed up for the OBGYN Intern Challenge, go to www.obgyninternchallenge.com where you can go ahead and sign up, do our survey, and this will get you set up for our text message course later on in the year.
We'll see you for the curriculum. Faye, it feels really nice to be back and recording podcasts again after parental leave, but you know, even 6 weeks later, I feel like I have missed a whole world of things in OBGYN.
Yeah, me too, especially 9 weeks out. But thankfully for us, we can refresh our memory with the OBG project.
That's right. The OBG project kind of has their great, great summaries and these bullet point formats online. They've got resident exclusive resources, the core curriculum, and they've got a new project in the primary care med project. You can check that out as well, which lets you get up to date with all those primary care guidelines that we got to keep up with too.
And even better, if you're a resident, remember that you can get OBG First absolutely free. So if you want to figure out how to do that, go ahead and go onto our website, click on the sidebar, and link to the OBG project.
All right, guys, welcome back. This is Nick.
This is Faye.
And this is
Kreogs over coffee.
All right, so we are finally back now with the promised part three of our coverage, if you will, on the new clinical practice guideline number 8 from ACOG that covers sort of labor and labor guidance. So, Faye, what are we going to use as our learning objectives today?
Yeah, so today we're going to review the evidence for certain interventions meant to reduce obstetric interventions for abnormal labor, and we're going to contrast the new CPG-8 guidance with the now retired ACOG and SMFM obstetric care consensus number 1. If you want, you can go back to our previous podcasts where we talked about some of these things, like part 2 of preventing the primary C-section and also limiting interventions in labor and birth, and we'll post this in the episode description and on our website. So, Nick, the last part of our coverage on this new guideline comes in the final section of the document under the heading Special Adjunctive Considerations. And CPG 8 doesn't replace the committee opinion 766 on approaches to limiting interventions of birth and labor, but they cover a lot of the same ground. So I think we are going to talk about some of the same things. So let's start off with continuous labor support. Tell me a little bit about what this guideline says about that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Faye, continuous labor support was covered in Committee Opinion 766. So this just kind of is a little bit of an update to that. But they define continuous labor support just so we're all on the same page as the continuous presence of support personnel or the continuous presence of a one-on-one person for support. And this support kind of comes in a lot of different forms that were included in sort of reviewing literature on this. So can include emotional support, providing continuous information about labor progress, providing advice about coping techniques, providing or facilitating comfort measures, or speaking up on behalf of the pregnant individual when they're needed to. So again, really a lot of different ways that this support comes, and sometimes it's even in many or all of those ways. But interestingly, in CPG 8, this is actually labeled as one of the most effective tools to improve labor and delivery outcomes. And so continuous labor support has had a decent amount of study in the literature and a large systematic review kind of looking at pregnant patients who are allocated to continuous support versus not continuous support benefited from a whole host of things. So they were more likely to have vaginal deliveries. They were less likely to have negative feelings about their childbirth experience. They were less likely to use any intrapartum analgesia. they had shorter labors. They were less likely to have C-sections. They were less likely to have operative births. And they were less likely as well to have a neonate with a 5-minute Apgar score of 7 or less. So again, a whole host of benefits, interestingly enough, from continuous labor support. And so the guideline is fairly strong here. It says that OBGYNs and healthcare providers or healthcare organizations should strive to develop policies and programs to really integrate trained support personnel into intrapartum care, so that way we can provide this one-to-one support for laboring persons that does seem to improve outcomes. All right, so now I think, though, Faye, we're going to get into a little bit of the more questionable levels of supports for things, and probably some controversy, so please save your rotting tomatoes at home. We're just reporting the facts here. we're going to start with a love it or hate it type of phenomenon, the peanut ball.
Yep. So the peanut ball, as you all know, it's definitely on your unit, whether or not you choose to use it or not. So this is an elongated peanut-shaped kind of like bouncing ball, typically placed between a patient's legs during labor while the patient is side-lying in order to, quote-unquote, open up the pelvis. And in theory, this mimics upright positioning with the opening of the pelvis. So the research on this, there has been a systematic review of 4 randomized trials of 648 patients, and this found no significant difference for time in labor or incidence of vaginal delivery or cesarean delivery with peanut ball use. There were non-significant trends, though, towards improving vaginal delivery rates and shortening the first stage of labor. But evidence is further limited as guidance for how to use the peanut ball, what size of the peanut ball to use, how long to use it, when to use it. As you can imagine, there's a lot of variability on peanut ball use overall. And how the peanut ball is implemented in labor courses is heterogeneous and driven a lot by personal or nursing experience. And so really more studies are needed to understand when and if it might be efficacious in particular scenarios. All right, so that is the peanut ball. Let's talk a little bit about what they have to say about position changes and ambulation.
Yeah, kind of related and, you know, probably similarly to the peanut ball, honestly. There's a lot of opinions on the role of position changes, when to change position, or if ambulation is necessary or a normal part of it. It being labor, that is. And, you know, observational studies show that when you leave patients to their own devices unanesthetized during labor, they assume a lot of different positions, basically trying to figure out what is comfortable for them. And that makes a lot of sense, right? And so the thought behind this is that that's a normal physiologic part, is moving around, changing positions really is not just partly figuring out what's comfortable, but also facilitating the actual process of labor and birth. A meta-analysis that compared upright positioning, so sitting, standing, or kneeling positions, along with ambulation, or both of those things. Again, comparing that group to recumbent lateral or supine positions as the other group, found that during the first stage of labor, the length of labor was reduced ultimately by about an hour and 22 minutes on average. And also patients who were in upright or ambulatory positions were less likely to undergo cesarean section with a relative risk of 0.71. There was another review that found no differences in those same factors, but did find reduced trauma to the pelvic floor for those in a kneeling position. So overall, maybe a mixed bag here, but evidence sort of pointing towards benefit. And so CPG-8 really encourages position changes to enhance maternal comfort and promote optimal fetal positioning. Again, not a lot of guidance on what to implement or if there's a specific sequence, but really just leaning into your patient and into your learned knowledge over time with this. Faye, one that I didn't really know about before or spend a lot of time thinking about in the literature was hydration.
Sure. So this clinical practice guideline notes that IV hydration is safe in labor, but it does limit the freedom of movement and overall may not be necessary, saying that oral hydration can be encouraged to meet caloric and hydration needs. And that makes sense because if you're tied to an IV pole, you're much less likely to move around. They did, in this guideline, talk about a systematic review comparing 250 cc's per hour of IV fluids to 125 cc's per hour in low-risk patients in spontaneous labor at term, and they demonstrated a lower risk of C-section reduction for any indication in the 250 cc per hour group. So that was 12.5% versus 18.1%. The higher fluid rate also shortened the duration of labor by about 1 hour on average, and second stage specifically by just under 3 minutes. But they did not observe increasing maternal or neonatal morbidities, including pulmonary edema. And so they recommended increased hydration for nulliparous patients when oral intake is restricted. But further study is still needed to compare when oral intake or oral hydration is not restricted and when patients are undergoing an induction of labor or if other comorbidities exist. All right. And last but not least, Nick, I think we also need to talk about cervical exams.
Yeah, I think another big controversy, and one that when you think about it, right, the idea of like, if you examine the cervix more frequently, do you introduce the risk for infection? And does that pan out? No, the guideline does say that, you know, the frequency of cervical examination is often cited with this as a concern for infection and really has to be balanced against the understanding of labor progress and facilitating these interventions that we spoke about in the first two parts of this series that prevent arrest or dystocia. The clinical practice guideline authors point really is the only study in this realm, a retrospective cohort study of 2,400 patients over a 4-year period that showed no association between the number of cervical exams in labor and the development of intrapartum fever. And that association was also not present when you just confined it to exams after amniotomy. So again, limited data that's here and retrospective in nature, but not pointing to an association between exams and infection. Perhaps something that some enterprising person out there might be willing to take up for a randomized trial or a trial of protocols. All right, Faye. Well, I think that that does it. That's really the coverage from CPG 8 on sort of special considerations with labor and delivery. Why don't we try to quickly summarize?
Sure. So the first thing that this CPG talks about is continuous labor support, where there is a continuous presence of a one-on-one person for support. And this can be in many forms. And it does note that this is one of the most effective tools to improve labor and delivery outcomes, where those who had continuous support were more likely to have vaginal deliveries, less likely to have C-sections, less likely to have operative vaginal deliveries, a whole host of benefits. So that we should strive to develop policies and programs to integrate some form of support personnel into intrapartum care.
The next thing we talked about was the peanut ball. You love it or you hate it, but it's there on your unit. Again, those peanut-shaped balls that in theory mimic upright positioning by allowing the pelvis to open up. The systematic review of 4 randomized trials noted in this clinical practice guideline found no significant difference with respect to time in labor, incidence of vaginal or cesarean delivery with peanut ball use. There were some non-significant trends towards vaginal delivery, though, but the evidence is kind of limited because really there's not a lot of guidance with respect to how to use the peanut ball, what size to use, how to use it, when to use it. You get the idea. Much more studies are needed to understand the efficacy in particular scenarios.
In terms of position change and ambulation, there are observational studies that show that patients assume many different labor positions during labor when they're left to their own devices. And a meta-analysis comparing those in upright position, ambulation, or both with recumbent lateral or supine positions did show that the upright position reduced for stage length, and these patients were less likely to undergo cesarean section, but a separate review found no difference in these factors. However, we do encourage position changes to enhance maternal comfort and promote optimal fetal positioning.
Next, we talked about hydration, which is safe through the IV, but the IV can limit freedom of movement. You're tied to that IV pole. CPG 8 states that oral hydration can be encouraged to meet caloric and hydration needs, but they also mention that for patients who are restricted in PO intake, a systematic review compared 250 versus 125 cc's per hour of fluid in low-risk patients undergoing spontaneous labor at term, demonstrating a reduced risk of C-section for any indication in the 250 cc per hour group. They also didn't observe any maternal or neonatal morbidities, including pulmonary edema. Again, further studies needed to understand comparison to oral intake when patients are undergoing inductions or if certain comorbidities exist, whether this fluid strategy is appropriate.
And finally, while frequency of cervical exams is often cited as a concern for infection, the authors of this practice guideline noted that there was a retrospective cohort study that showed no significant association between number of cervical exams in labor and intrapartum fever, and this was also not present when confined to exams after their water was broken. All right, Nick, I think that brings us to the end of this episode. So once again, this is Faye.
This is Nick.
And this has been Kreogs Over Coffee.
So guys, if you enjoyed the podcast, head over to iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, whatever your podcatcher is. Give us a 5-star rating and review.
You can find us on social media on X at KreogsOverCoff1, on Facebook and Instagram at KreogsOverCoffee. And if you want to donate to the show, go ahead and go over to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/KreogsOverCoffee.
You can find show notes for this episode and all of our previous episodes on our website, KreogsOverCoffee.com.
And if you want to reach out to us, have a question about the show, have ideas for an episode or a correction for us, go ahead and email us, KreogsOverCoffee@gmail.com.